Okay, welcome to the world of IPv6, to a session we'll deep dive into some of the protocols. We'll show you that it's not as dangerous as everyone says it is. It's not that far away. A quick question for you. How many of you attended yesterday's session on IPv6? Hands up. Okay, that's pretty much most of you. There will be some repeats in the start of this session, but I'll try to get into the deeper stuff as soon as possible, checking out the protocols. My name is Daniel Sorlov. I work with IPv6 daily. And let's start. IP isn't actually as new as everyone thinks. And IPv6 isn't new. It's actually got quite a few years on its back already. That means that we already have a lot of experience in deploying, maintaining IPv6 networks. So it's nothing new. We actually also gone through a couple of revisions already, where we changed some stuff that didn't work. We have implemented other stuff that to replace that. So it's actually still a process, even if I'm saying that since 1995, the first of the IPv6 RFCs was published. It's been a trip since that. Today, we're going to talk about the RFC that's 2640. This is what defines IPv6 as it is today. So that's where we're going to look. The drive for IPv6 started with us noticing a lot of problems with IPv4. IPv4 is designed, let me not call it smaller networks, because that sounds a bit strange, because the internet is quite big, but it's designed many years ago and not seeing the problems that we're seeing today with the amount of traffic, the amount of addresses, and so on. One of the biggest issues is the header sections. They're complicated, they got a checksum in them, so every router on every hop for every packet has to go down and calculate those numbers to make sure they got the right package. We got things as fragmentation, let's add on to that. We got a lot of add-on protocols that needs to be processed at every node. All that increases the load of the routers and the hosts. So that's one problem that we are addressing with IPv6. The limited address space, that's another problem. And I think if you know something, anything about IPv6, that is the thing that you heard. I think it was last year in Sweden, in February, there was big headlines in the newspaper saying, the internet is dying. It's going to stop. The addresses are out. We cannot do it anymore. Of course, nothing happened, because we are still finding ways around those problems, such as using NAT. NAT is actually one of the things that I've listed on the problem slides for IPv4. If you work with NAT, if you're used to FTP, IP phones, stuff like that, soft phones, then you know that NAT isn't a really good protocol. It adds complexity. It adds problems to troubleshooting. I've met customers that are NATing their NATed networks just to get around different problems that they could solve so very simply by implementing IPv6. I do recognize the big problems in implementing IPv6, and that's us. All of us in here that do not today have the knowledge to implement and drive IPv6. We're a bit unsure of what we're doing. As the other session yesterday said, most of you already have implemented IPv6 because you have Windows Vista, you have Windows 7, you have Windows 8 machines, 2008 R2s, and so on your network. They already got this stuff enabled by default, preferred. The machines are actually talking to each other on that protocol. When we're doing pen testing, when I'm helping with that, one of the things we're used to doing is going in, setting up an IPv6 machine, just plugging it in, and noticing there is no firewalls, there is no policies, there is nothing. It's like no one thought about it being enabled. So, okay, returning to the problems at hand. We have no quality of service. That's an add-on for IPv4. We got no encryption. We got no integrity. That's also add-ons. It actually was developed for IPv6, IPsec, and then backported into IPv4. So if you know that stuff, you already know some IPv6. So these are the main problems that we were seeing with IPv4. So, big question, are we really out of addresses? This is a couple of weeks ago, the statistics. We're looking at 32 bits. That gives some, is that 4 billion addresses? That are available, 256/8 blocks. Those are all given out. There are some reserved blocks that could be moved around. And as I said, us being one of the problems here, we are sure to find a way to get even some more addresses out of this space that we already get. So, but we are out of addresses. IANA, which is the top-level distributor of blocks, they are exhausted. They do not have any more. If we look at APNIC, which is the Asia-Pacific regional IP registry, they have no more address space, basically. They are down to their last block. They are down to giving very, very few addresses. They are actually preferring to give IPv6. And if you're active in that part of the world, if you're not connected to IPv6, you're missing out on business. RIPE, which is the European, is about to enter that last block. And when they do hit that number, they come into a point where they actually decrease the number of addresses being given out. They're getting harder to get and so on. So the last address is, I think, in November 2014. Then we are out of addresses. The last couple of weeks I've been in business with one of the telcos in Sweden that actually has no more addresses for subscribers. So they were forced into implementing IPv6 for end users. End users does not know it yet because we're still hiding it in the end user equipment. We're using some transition technology to make sure that people, the ordinary people, doesn't have to know IPv6 yet. So this is the situation as it is now. There are the escape theory, that we can escape this. One of which APNIC has already started, that's the top one, decrease the allocation policy, give out less address space. The other one is NAT, port NATing, that breaks stuff. That's basically breaking the internet as we know it. It's affecting protocols with embedded IP addresses in them because we need to have proxies, we need to have agents that actually translate stuff in gateways, which even further increases how much hardware we need at the edge of our networks. NAT also have a very dangerous feature. It's perceived as a security measure. It's perceived as, oh, this is a firewall device. If you look at the Soho and home devices, they're all, oh, it's a NAT firewall. And people are actually believing that that is security. It's just poor translation, basically. So that's why we don't want to go that route. Instead, we want to go this route. We want to go 128 bits IPv6. I think it's 340 undecillion addresses available. It should cover our future needs. I know that have been said a lot of times about RAM, about hard drives, and a lot of other stuff, but I'm pretty sure. The addresses themselves in IPv6 are split into two parts. It's a network ID, and it's an interface ID. 64-bit each. So subnetting, all that stuff we learned with IPv4, it have become a lot simpler. I'll go back to that in a little while in this presentation. But the subnetting, it's have been simplified in many ways because we don't need to think about it in the same way that we had with IPv4. Just to bring a bit of perspective on that number, when numbers pass a certain size, it just becomes, well, unclear of how big that 4.28 to the power of 1020 addresses per square inch. Okay. If there is anyone who needs more addresses than that, well, come up and talk to me, and yeah, I want to know. Well, the other planet, yeah. We'll have planetary natting. Okay, let's start looking at those 120 bits. This is going into the addressing. We're breaking it down. I'll go quite hard with all the bits and bytes and of the protocol. The first 3 bits are reserved. That's for the public internet today. That's just to keep everything under control. If we look at the next part, we have the 45 bits, that's the routing prefix. A small part of that is given from IANA to the regional internet registries. And they, in their part, give out to local internet registries, which in part gives it to customers, as in internet providers. And then we have /48, which is the most common to actually give to a customer, end customer. That's a lot of addresses. So, will this be enough? As I said, there are people that are saying, we should make an even bigger number. But if we're looking at it, every 18 months or so, we are getting a request for new address space. That means that in 2158, the current assigned block will be consumed. Okay, then we still have seven parts of eight left to give out. So there's loads of address space. So I'm feeling fairly confident. So you know what I'm talking about, a bit of terminology. We have a node. A node is a system that talks IPv6, whether be it a router or a host or a server, a cell phone, whatever. That's a node. That's a single node. A router, that is something that routes packages from A to B. That could be your Windows 7 or 8 machine with internet connection sharing on. Then that machine becomes a router. Then that machine does some protocol stuff, which we're going to talk about later on, the router announcements. So that's a router. That's something connecting to networks. A host, that is something that do not route. So if you want to distinguish between a node, router, and then the rest are hosts. Link, that is a Ethernet cable. That is a connection from a network card to a switch. That's a link. A link is a LAN or WAN network. A neighbor, we're going to talk about neighbor discovery. We don't have ARP anymore. So, because that would be, you know, ARP. How that's, and if you're thinking about the number of machines that we are placing in each subnet, that would not be a liable option. So neighbors, that is a computer that's on the same link as I am. Not saying that he's connected to the same switch, but he's in the same LAN as myself. That's a neighbor. And just to round that off, between neighbors, we send packets. That's a header and a data section. So what did change? This is a very short list of the most common changes that have been made. One is simplified headers. They are fixed size headers, which makes it easy for writers to look at the header section. They know how much data they need to look at. If you're running an IPv4 router today, and you change that to an IPv6 configuration only, I'm not talking about mixed where you have both IPv4 and 6, but to a pure IPv6, that router CPU will decrease due to the headers actually being easier to process. So we've seen that at a couple of customer sites. They didn't have to upgrade. But to get there, you will need to upgrade because you will need to run both IPv6 and 4 at the same time, which will increase how much resources you will need. You will need two routing tables. And the routing tables, well, IPv6 addresses are a bit bigger, so the table will become a bit bigger. We have quality of services built into the protocol. We're going to look at that when we come to the header section. There are some flags that can be set per package, per application. There is a framework for this already built in, as is all the IPsec stuff. And one of the things I love about IPv6 is the last bullet down there. It's self-configuring. It is almost to the point where you actually just plug a machine in and it works. You don't have to set up a DHCP server. You don't have to set up a DNS server and so on. I'll get to a couple of different scenarios where we will use DHCP or we won't use DHCP depending on what the problem we want to solve is. I had a customer once, he called me and said, "Hey, I'm getting a lot of MAC addresses in my log files." This is the format of the IPv6 address. It kind of looks like a MAC address, so I did understand what he was talking about. Every block is 16 bits. It's separated by colons. These addresses, I hear what many people are saying, they are harder to remember. But to be truthful, how many IP addresses do we really remember? Okay, our router, our main router, that perhaps is one of them. But otherwise, do we all remember all the server's IP addresses? No, probably not. So you could learn the ones that you need to learn. But we have one helper here. You've heard about DNS, right? Something new, it's exciting. You can actually register addresses in there, so you can look them up. That simplifies a lot. So this is one address. As you can see, we have FE80. I'll go into what that prefix stands for, but after that, you'll see a series of zeros. And after that, you will see a block that starts with 0290. To make it more simple to remember, to write, to document all these addresses, there are a couple of techniques we can use. One is zero group compression. That takes a group of zeros, one group of zeros. Cannot do it twice in an address, just once. And it actually removes those zeros. So we strike out that part of the address. Then second technology for this is leading zero trimming. And we trim out all the leading zeros in each block. That is for the 0290 and the 0070. And the resulting address becomes this. The zero group is denoted by the two colons after each other. You can only do that once, because if you did it twice, you would have to guess how many zeros in each place. And I think that, well, this address tends to be a little less complicated to learn. Not much, but still, and still we got DNS to help us along. The addresses are in hex, so that's one of the issues we're seeing is that, well, we're not native in hex, most of us, and well, it becomes a hassle to just handle the addresses that way. The current allocations is as this list. You'll have the link down at the bottom of the slide as well if you want to up-to-date and have the full link to the information. This is 15%. While that seems like a big number, I just explained that there are still loads of address space unused. So don't get scared by that number. Already now, I want to make sure that the site locals, the FEC0 addresses that have been depreciated, it is not in use anymore. I will show you a couple of places in Windows where it's actually being used still in some certain cases, but it is not used anymore. If we look at the second line, you'll find global unicast 2000:/3. That is the public internet. These are the internet addresses that are available to us. Third line, link local. Link local is between machines. It do not cross router borders. It is that link. Actually, the link local addresses are used for your host to communicate with a router. In most cases, even if you both have a public address. So that address is quite important to know. I'm sure that you have seen it on your workstation when you do an ipconfig/all. It lists that address and, oh, two MAC addresses, you thought. Multicast. We have no broadcast. I'm getting back to that, but we have no broadcast anymore. So multicast is the way forward. Separate place for that. And then we got the ULA, unique local addresses at the bottom. Those addresses are, I don't like to talk about them because they're like the 10.0.0. It's if you want to do something very, very local. I would use it in my lab for lab usage. It's not for routing on the public internet. It's not guaranteed to be a unique address. So, but you got a full /7 for that. There are actually some parts of the public address space that are set aside for stuff like documentation. So there are specific addresses you will recognize, 2001:DB8. That's for documentation. We have so many addresses, so we can actually dedicate a full block to just being the ones we use in documentation. And that's because no one should by mistake copy-paste something into a router. You probably heard about people announcing 0.0.0 in their router by BGP that kind of get them a lot of traffic into their routers. So the mistakes shouldn't be able to happen again by that. But the full list, you'll find that at link if you're interested in deep diving into that. So, we do use FEC0 addresses in Windows. These addresses, you might have seen them already when you're doing an ipconfig. They are actually defaulting to that value. There was a plan to that all the DNSs in the world, everywhere, should have the same address. I kind of like that idea, actually. Would be easy to remember. So if no config is given by DHCP in Windows or router announcements in other operating systems, I'm getting back to that Windows doesn't listen to those, and that's a design decision, and I think it's a sound one as well. So if nothing is configured either manually or by DHCP, you will see these DNS servers. There is nothing that says that you cannot use IPv4 for DNS. You will still be able to query your DNS server. You'll still be able to get a quad A response with an IPv6 address and then connect over that network. So the DNS service isn't the first thing you need to move on to IPv6, but it could possibly be that. So this is a last resort only. What you could do, and what I've seen a lot of customers do, is actually set these addresses up in their routers and then point to the DNS servers. That makes sure that it always works, even if someone is implementing an old IPv6 stack. Okay, so the addresses have been more complicated up to now. I'll give you two good things. Loopback, :1, very, very simple. It's even shorter than the IPv4 version. So, and I expect you all to learn that by this session. Unspecified, :0.0.0.0, :, also very simple. Those two, you need to know on the back of your hand, and it's 5 characters in total, so you should be able to do that. Okay, let's start with link local addresses. Link local is the first thing your machine brings up on an interface. That is the address that it used to communicate with the router. It's FE80 prefixed. It's very similar to what you've seen in Windows in the past, automatic private IP addressing, the 169.254 space, where the machine actually goes up, it assigns itself an address, checks so no one else had that address, and then assigns that address. The whole thought about that namespace in IPv4 was to make sure that your routers could actually just, well, home users, they could just plug in and everything would work. They didn't need a DHCP server. But we didn't get there. So it's used for on-link only. It should not, could not, whatever. You shouldn't route it. That brings a lot of problems. And most routers out there doesn't route it. It's not allowed. It can't be done. It's forbidden. This is what we're using to get our real address to talk to the router so we can get a public address from the router. Get back to that process in a while. Let's talk a bit about multicast. Oh, did you see that? I made an error in the animation. Anyway, we have flags. The flags says if this is a well-known multicast space or not. We can create on-the-fly new spaces. We have a scope that says how wide is this multicast address to be node local, link local, or global internet. Group IDs, and you'll see that in a while when I start to talk about router announcements and how those goes out. We have a couple of different group IDs. One is all nodes. So if you send to all nodes multicast address, well, all nodes receive that message. If you send it to all routers multicast space, well, all routers receive it. But do mind, all routers also includes all the internet connection sharing machines. They are now routers. If you go on to the site, this deck will be available with some notes and links and stuff in the PowerPoints themselves, so go ahead and download that later on. You'll find some references there. Global unicast space, the 2001 address space, is divided into these blocks. So basically, oh yeah, the IPv4 mapped addresses is also deprecated or depreciated, or how that's pronounced. The interface ID, that is the local ID for each interface, of course. It is the, it could be an auto-generated. It is 64 bits. That is why when we're doing subnetting, you'll always see that, oh, you get a /64. Get a lot of addresses. And that was these processes should work. We'll get back to that. Okay, the thing I didn't want, as I said, the ULAs, unique local addresses. This space is to be treated like the RFC 1918 addresses. It is a private space. Even if NAT isn't existing as a technology in IPv6, you could do that. But there is no reason whatsoever. And if anyone does and you're gone to my session, well, I'm not proud of you. Well, why would you? You have so many addresses. Use public addressing. If you start to think about it, what many people say is, oh, well, then anyone could access my machines. No, that's what you have firewalls to protect you against, right? So if you have a local firewall on that machine, is there a problem with it being accessed or being accessible? No, it's protected, right? We can use IPsec to make sure that we can't even talk to the machine before we know who we are, have identified. So it's no problem with public addresses on all nodes. It just solves a lot of problems. But we're not used to that luxury of having that many addresses. So, but use ULA in labs. It's a good thing to have. And then you can blacklist or make sure that these addresses aren't routed in your production environment. So that's you could use it as a safeguard to make sure that it isn't used in production. Okay, a short wake-up call. Let's see. Just to show you that things haven't changed as much as you think. We're still using the same tools as we have before. Let me just check so I'm connected still. I am. And this will also show that it prefers it didn't. Okay. And that's because I don't have a connection, right? Okay, it's normally supposed to, or it does prefer IPv6 if that is working. But we have a built-in feature that actually checks, is IPv6 working or not? And in this case, my connection isn't working, my tunnel isn't up. That's why it falls back to a IPv4. But as you can see, when I'm using ping, it does seamlessly go between the two protocols. I can, if I want to, force it to use a specific version of IP when pinging. So I can actually see that Google does have a quad A record for their public www address. Okay, since the connection isn't working, I'm falling back to a demo machine here just to show you that the NS lookup, that works, it have always. Let's check the internetexample.com. What we can see here is also that these tools, they handle IPv6 addresses, quad A records, just as they handle any A record. And what happens when I query for the internet.example.com, we'll look at that zone a bit later on, It actually returns both the A record and the quad A record. If IPv6 is working, it will prefer to use the IPv6 address. If it cannot reach that address, it will fall back. If you're using Windows 7, that fallback process is a lot longer than in Windows 8. Okay, that was some very basic address space. I believe everyone now remembers all the address spaces and all the prefixes and all the bit prefixes and stuff like that, so we'll just move ahead. This is how a node gets its address. There are a couple of different methods of obtaining an address. First of all is manual configuration. This has been done in all times. You go down to the node, you just enter an address. Just as simple as it was in IPv4, it is in IPv6. The problem with statically assigned IP addresses is that if you need to change them, you need to go back to the node, right? So, but it's possible. We do have auto-configuration of addresses. That is, generating an IP address on the fly. We do have a resolution protocol for that called DAD. Duplicate address detection. I'll talk about that later on. We can also assign administratively using DHCP version 6. I'll show that console and options in there a bit later on. That basically is the same process as it was in IPv4. I'll not go into the other ones. You can read on the notes for the slides. We'll find more documentation on those. This is what most operating systems except Windows uses. That's why it is important to know it. Why Windows isn't using it is because we're seeing a privacy issue. If we would derive the IP address of your machine from the network card, the MAC address, as this model shows, then we could possibly track you, right? Because you would have the same address. The only thing that would change between locations would be the prefix. So that's why we don't do that in Windows. But it is important to know how other systems do this, routers, etc. So we have our MAC address. We add in the middle, FFE. So if you see that in an address, you'll know that it's being generated by this method. And then we have a bit of a trick. We look at the first block, and we then inverse one of the bits, just to keep it confusing. And we got what's called a modified EUI. So this is the address of your system. This should not collide because there should not be two network cards with the same MAC address, right? So, but we've all been there, I think. Specifically with cheaper cards, they could be using the same chip and an image for all of them, so. Absolutely. IPv6 headers, I did brag about them. They are 40 bytes. This is what they are and nothing more than this. This is what you'll always see. Like the version field, of course, that is set to 4. No, it's set to 6, right? The version is 6. Then we have a couple of fields. I'll get back to them in just a couple of seconds. We got the payload length, which actually says how big is the data we're transferring. That's no science. Then we got the magic next header. That could point to another fixed size header, like hop-by-hop options, source writing options, or whatever. But for the router, except for source routing, we do not need to look at any more headers. It's not necessary. We don't need to know about it. That's why we just have a pointer to that. So our router can just process this. He's looking at the next two fields, which is the source and destination address. That's what's interesting at that specific stage. Then when the package arrive at the node, then all the headers get interesting. But that doesn't have to be processed at every stage. There's also a hop limit. So fixed length, it is not protected by checksum, so we can actually do some changes. This does not mean that we can change the data inside. We still have integrity, we'll still have encryption. But the package itself is easier to handle. This is the suggested order for the additional headers. And this is just to give you an idea of what headers there is and what you can do. I'm not going to deep dive into all of these headers. Destination header, routing headers, is to make it possible for us to do source routing. And some of you might remember that I started out by saying, oh, there is no fragmentation. There isn't while in transit, but you can do some fragmentation using the fragment header. Again, there is better ways of doing that most probably. The AH authentication header, so that points to the ESP header. They point to each other one by one. We have a suggested order that makes it more simple for the node receiving it and for the routers on the way over to where the package is going. If there are unknown headers, the RFC says that the package should not be handled. The recommended ordering, there is one. I had part of it on the slide, and you'll find more of it in the notes. It all ends with the header 59 that says, well, there is no more headers. This is the end of the road. We're done. Getting back to the two fields I skipped when we looked at the header was the traffic class and the flow label. Traffic class, that's just as pretty much similar to what was type of service in IPv4. We set that to something and then we can handle the package accordingly along the way. Then we have something called a flow label. That's described in RFC 3997. It's actually where you can go in and have a specific application or an instance of an application. So you can see the stream of packages originating from that specific application and or OS or whatever you want to use it for to make sure that a specific application or stream of data is processed accordingly with high priority, low priority, or how we want to handle it along the way. So we can actually see that this package belongs to this series. It belongs to this application. And if you're starting to think about it, oh, that means that my line of business application could actually be prioritized above web browsing. That gives a whole new meaning of quality of service. Both of these are to some extent still experimental in how the RFCs are written. There are a lot of shoulds in there. So if you want to go down this road and if you want to show your developers how they can use these, because you will need some specific, it's not just checking a box or something. You have to go specific to the application. Read the RFC, read it one more time and then another time and then you should be prepared to read it the final time. So, 3697. That's a good read. IPv4, we had ICMP, IGMP, ARP, etc. A lot of control protocols. This was more just to make sure that you understand that there is only one control protocol in IPv6. That's ICMP. That protocol is more than it have ever been. You cannot, in your firewall, set up a rule that says drop all ICMP packages, because you won't even be able to connect to another node without this, because we have some path MTU values, amongst other things, that are calculated and brought forward using ICMP messages. So ICMP version 6, it's pretty much what ICMP always been. We got a type field. Very simply, the first 127 types are errors, 128 and the rest are informal. They could be stating that the package is too big, or that it reached its destination, or it was redirected, or other things. We also, in the ICMP package, include the invoking package. So if I send a packet and that is too large to be received in that end, I will receive that package or the start of it back, just to make sure that I know which packet it was. The ICMP messages may not be fragmented, and they may not be a reply to an error or redirect message. So if I get an error message, I cannot reply to that error message. Of course, why would I? I would need to handle error instead. Multicast replaces broadcast. Everything that we did by broadcast before is done in some way using either multicast or some other method, or simply being removed. So all nodes must support this. That means that all steps of your network needs to support this. Personally, I haven't seen a single network equipment that haven't had support for multicast in, you know, forever. Perhaps the one that I installed at my grandmother's, that perhaps doesn't have that support, but the things we are playing with, no problems. But you need to have it there, need to enable it, and some switches and stuff do have limitations on how much multicast traffic there can be at a port. Make sure you know that value isn't the problem. It could actually delay your deployment because it's hindering the packages. So multicast, it's used to talk to our neighbors. There are a couple of groups that are good to know. Node local groups, FF01. And then we have the FF02, which is the link local. So if I send information to FF02, :1, that is received by all of the nodes on my link. And that could potentially be very many machines, right? But it serves its purpose. It could be needed. The more useful or more practical groups are, for instance, routers, which, you see, it's basically the same prefix. It's just :2. So if I want to check all of my routers on my link, I send a message to FF02:2. Then all the routers could respond with their routing tables or router announcement messages, as they're called, a prefix list with what can I reach. So the nodes are actually discovering the network instead of being handed the information as before. That also means that when we're doing the router announcements, we need to think about priorities. Imagine the situation where we actually have two internet gateways. We send out a multicast message asking for all the routers. They both respond with a default route. Which of the routers should I choose for my outbound traffic? Well, the network team has to solve that by setting a priority. Nodes with similar addresses are joined in what's called a solicited node multicast group. It's the lower 24 bits of a node address. This is very useful for detecting duplicate addresses, for instance. You will see the example address. It joins a solicited node multicast group. So you need to know that that's the lower 24 bits of the node address. So all machines joins into that and listens to that address. So, neighbor discovery, finding neighbors. I've started to talk about it a bit. It is using ICMPv6, multicast messages. What happens is that we send out a query, NS query, saying, hey, I need a router. The router then responds with a neighbor advertisement. Sorry, not the router. The host responds with a neighbor announcement. There are two types of announcements. Either they are periodic. That means that the host is just broadcasting them out. I'm here, I'm alive. So everyone knows that. Then the flag of that message is set to 2. Just to know when you get that message, it's not somebody I asked for, it's just to keep me updated on who's there. So it's a way for the operating system to prioritize and to put them in the right cache and stuff like that. There are two caches, neighbor cache and destination cache. They're kept there, they are periodically being removed from there as well. This is basically what replaces ARP. This is how we find our nodes. We send out a message and we get a reply. We can also have something called neighbor discovery proxies. This is when I see your message and you're looking for neighbors, and I have a list of neighbors, so I'll just send it to you. Then I become a proxy. And I must then also say in what state those addresses are. Are they reachable and stale as an old record, or are they very fresh? So nodes are actually helping each other on updating the lists of neighbors. As I said, this is done by ICMP. So if you're blocking ICMP, that basically means you cannot communicate with any nodes on the network because they won't locate each other. If you want to do firewall stuff, look at the type fields. There are loads of types. Go into that list, check them off. Which do you need to actually forward and which can you drop? So this is, as I said, the new ARP. It reduces network load significantly. We've seen this in a couple of networks which are live today with about 100,000 nodes. They reduce traffic by about 40% in types of this communication. So that's very good. We got something that's called Anycast. How many of you have heard about Anycast in IPv4? A couple of you. Anycast basically is where you set the same address on multiple nodes. You can actually also advertise the same address on multiple nodes by BGP and stuff like that. So this is commonly used for DNS servers. The root DNS servers, amongst other things, are in this way. There are no way of distinguishing a unicast address from a anycast address, because an anycast address is a unicast address just set up on multiple machines. You will always go to the nearest one, since the route will be to the nearest one. So that's a way of geographically dividing or making sure that you have availability and services. Okay, a single node, when that comes up and it's going to get its address, we had a couple of different methods of obtaining addresses. Interface ID is generated either manually or automatically, or by using a well-defined like FEAD address. As I said, in Windows, we randomly generate that address. In other operating systems, we are deriving it from the MAC address. So we take that address, we bring it online, but we are not actively using it. We are listening to it. And then we use DAD, Duplicate Address Detection. So this is what happens. Node X starts and assigns address Y on the interface. Interface then joins the multicast groups. And when it have joined those groups, it can actually receive messages, right? So that means that if there are any neighbor I can't pronounce that. I'm not going to give up. If someone want to teach me, come up after the session, I'll be happy to learn. So if any NS queries are heard for that address, okay, someone else has my address. So the procedure starts again. We generate a new one. Then it becomes a bit more aggressive. It actually sends out a package. And here you can see it using the solicited nodes multicast group, sends out a message. If it sees a reply, what does that mean? Well, we've got another node with that address. So again, we'll take a new address. And if nothing is heard, then we bring this address up and we're starting to use this as a unicast address. This process is not performed by Windows for the randomly generated IPs. This process is called SLAC, Stateless Address Auto Configuration. During this process, we're doing a lot of multicasting of packages to routers to know what routers there is. So that's the next step. We got our address, we got that self-configured, auto-configured, and now we're going to find a router. So the routers have joined the multicast group for routers. We send a message to them saying, hey, what routers are there? An RS query. Then the router responds with an RA message that contains the information about which prefixes that router have. And based on that prefix, I can then assign myself a public address. Because I get back the 2001 whatever subnet I get back, and I take my 64 bits, interface ID, just append that, and I have a public address, and that should still be unique. So it's actually not given to me. I'm given a prefix, and then I'm calculating my own address in that. The router advertisement messages are sent out periodically as well as in response to a direct query. The router advertisements does contain some flags. One of the flags you can set is M and O. M means that, well, here is my prefixes, but you shouldn't calculate your address yourself. You should contact a DHCP server to get your address. Options means that I can get my options of a DHCP server, like domain name, like DNS servers, as I talked about earlier in the session. So the router advertisement message is being sent out continuously. So we actually need to talk to the network guys. We cannot just set up a DHCP server version 6 and that starts to giving out addresses. Actually, we need to talk to the guys managing the router, saying, hey, we want a manage flag set. Because otherwise, we're using Slack. This is what comes in a router advertisement message. Prefix, length, lifetime, how long is this link valid? Also, the MTU, the maximum transmission unit, how big packages can we send? This is vital in IPv6 as we are not supposed to, or we're not allowed to fragment packages, so we need to know how big can we make the packages. One thing about messages, do not route them. All nodes must, as specified in the RFC, handle all RA messages. So all nodes must process all RAs. If you go onto YouTube and you actually search death by RA, you can see how you very, very easily can bring down a network. And that is independent of the operating system, actually. All Windows versions are vulnerable today. All Linux and open source and whatever are vulnerable today. That's because every machine must take every message, look at it. Oh, is there a new prefix here? And then add that to its local routing table. So if I want to do an attack like that, I'll just pump out millions of RA messages. And you need to handle them all. And that brings down the machine. So how do you counteract that? Well, you restrict which ports can send RA messages. It should only be the routers. Then you're also solving the other problem, which I was talking about routers being the ones that had internet connection sharing on. Because those nodes, with their 3G modem or whatever, are routers and do announce a route. And, well, in a bad configured network, we could actually start using their connection out to the internet instead of the corporate one, based on the router announcement message. So by filtering router announcement messages, you're actually solving two problems at the same time. I'm actually skipping those and coming to this one. Fragmentation is by source only. Only the source can fragment. There is no more fragment flag. We're always starting at 1280 bytes. It's the package size we're starting off with. As we are sending packages, we are increasing that until we get an ICMP saying, package too big. Then we have decided how large the biggest package we can send is. So we're increasing from 1280 up to whatever number is for that link, and then we're saving that in the destination cache as well. Some nodes does not need to have the full capacity of the route or the prefix that you have been receiving from the router in the router announcement message. It could actually be less for a specific node, so that is saved into the destination cache. Path MTU value. So it measures the MTU along the way. Okay, IPv6 and DNS, if we're looking at DNS. Well, DNS is working as DNS always have. We have some new records. It's a quad A record. That's the new thing, a quad A. It's 4 times 32 bits, so it's a quad A. The thing that's not quite as it used to be is the reverse records. Every nibble, that's the 4 bits addresses, has to be written out. And as you can see the name on the screen where it says IPv6 ARPA at the end, that's the reverse zone. You don't want to manage that yourself. Of course, all the tools support this being done automatically, regardless, basically, on vendor. So, but the main thing about DNS is that it had become more important to maintain. As addresses are longer, you need DNS more than you have been, because before you would have been able to remember some addresses. If we do not want to use DNS, and I don't know why we wouldn't like to use DNS, there is something called LLMNR, Link Local Multicast Name Resolution. This is very similar to what we had in NetBIOS before. So we send out a message. All nodes listen to port 5355 UDP. Windows only does UDP. The RFC states also TCP, but we do UDP only. And we respond. It's a single label name only thing. So it is for that local, very small network where we don't actually need the infrastructure, I mean, at home. Because wherever we're having an Active Directory, we do have DNS. So we're going to use DNS. The actual resolution order in the operating system is first use DNS if we do not get a response from that. And if it is a single label name, that is, it's not a fully qualified domain name, we're using LLMNR first. And then we're falling back to NetBIOS. LLMNR can be used both for IPv4 and 6. So, but again, I don't really know why you would use this. It's for really small networks. Dual stack mode, this is what we're looking at. I've been talking IPv6 at least 10 years. At first, I had an audience about 2 people. And it's steadily getting there. But it's still a bit dangerous to talk about IPv6. It's not politically correct and all that. So we're looking at dual stack mode. And this is why I'm very, very confident that this actually is the year of IPv6. Because we are also beginning to accept that we don't need to go the whole way at once. We don't have to be native now. We can be dual stack. Newer systems function good, IPv6. Let them do IPv6 while we continue to decrease and remove the older systems while they are still... I haven't seen switches and stuff that doesn't support it in quite a while. That's real equipment, I mean... home gear, of course. I heard yesterday that there is a US-based Comcast or something, ISP, actually starting to roll this out in certain areas. And I was like, AT&T as well. I was like, yes, we don't have that in Sweden. So there are some tunneling protocols. Do not use them. You do not need them. Use NAT64 to translate between networks instead. It just converts an IPv6 to an IPv4 and vice versa. These technologies do have their place. It was covered to some extent in the session yesterday, so go online and find the recording of that if you want to know more about the tunneling. Writing, just to summarize, again, no big changes. The big change has been the address so far, right? All the other things, we've been able to map that into stuff you already know. So same thing here, is the routing is the same. We got some new protocols, RIPNG, BGP4+, OSPF version 3. And, well, as before, RIP got its problems with above 15 hops, it becomes slow, and BGP4, well, it works as BGP, always has been working. I'm announcing something and you're receiving my announcement. No strange things there. One note, though, is OSPF version 3. The IDs of the routers, they are written as 32-bit numbers. Still. they look like IPv4 addresses, but they aren't. They are 32-bit numbers that looks like, yeah. So, to summarize, we got loads more addresses. We got a better way of handling those addresses. We got end-to-end addressing. That is, I mean, the magnets on your fridge is going to have an IPv6 address. You will still not run out of addresses. So end-to-end, and it simplifies everything from firewalling to whatever. No fragmentation makes it even simpler to assemble packages. We do not need to calculate checksums, which makes the load for routers smaller. They become better. ICMP version 6 is all you need to know in control protocols. We got auto-configuration. We can manually configure if we want to. But the big thing is that we can do auto-configuration. Let me just quickly switch over to my demo machine. And this is more just to show you that everything is the same as it's always been. This is the DNS console. This is a 2012 server. I got my example.com zone. Okay, perhaps really not it's always been, but this is because I have some DNSSEC stuff in here as well. What I wanted to show you was this. This is my host. This is the name query I did before in the PowerShell window. The only difference is that it is a quad A record. The console is the same, the tools are the same, everything I've been able to do before is exactly the same. So all the same principle still applies. Let's go into routing and remote access. This tool is also the same as it's always been, except that we got a new node, IPv6. Also note, there is no NAT. We don't need it. Routing, properties. You click the IPv6 router, it becomes a router. You go into IPv6, you set which prefix should I distribute, and then you're off. Good to go. You can do static routes if you want to as well. Let's go into DHCP. You know the thing about scopes? You still got reservations, scope options. We don't have as many options as before. The list is a bit shorter. The one you want to configure is most probably this one. We give a list of DNS servers. This is when you have a managed flag for the address. This is from the router announcement saying, hey, it's a managed machine. Then it will contact the DHCP server via multicast, and the DHCP server will supply these additional options. Otherwise, exactly the same. The addresses are more complicated, but that's about it. A demo that I didn't want to do, sounds wrong, but a demo that I didn't do today, but I urge you to go down and do yourself, is the IPAM, IP Address Management. We got a built-in tool in 2012. Fantastic tool. It's let you manage, keep track of who did what, and when we have automatic addressing, you will need a log. Who had that address at what time? You can do that in that tool. Check that out. It's done in the hands-on labs. If you want to learn more, go to tunnelbroker.net. That's a learning-based tool. It will start with, what is an IP address? And you will get one. And when you've learned that, you will get more. And then you get a tunnel. And then you get even more. And then you get a badge saying, hey, I'm the IPv6 king. But it's good. It takes it step by step, interactive. Then you have GoGo 6. It's forums, it's reference materials, and it's the client I've used to connect which unfortunately didn't work in this network today, but it does give you an IPv6 address so you can actually access IPv6 internet natively. So those two tools are priceless for that. Very, very quickly, I'm going to tell you to, if you cannot remember addresses, use DNS. So that myth is. And if you're saying, I don't need it now, I'm going to do it later, you already got it. You already got it, and it's a risk for your network. I will be down in the exhibit later. If you have any questions, I'll be around, so feel free to reach out. And do not forget to do this session evaluation, because then you can win stuff. Thank you.